Eku iluna, arise. Enoho neika, aha, ho'o kolo kolo, ho'o pii kue. O kaluna kanavai, hano hano o Lisa M. Ganoza. A me ka luna kanavai, hano hano o Catherine G. Leonard. A me ka luna kanavai, hano hano o Keith K. Haroka. E ho'omalu nei. The Intermediate Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Chief Judge Lisa M. Ganoza, Catherine G. Leonard, and Keith K. Haroka, Associate Judges, presiding. E noho ilalo. Please be seated.
Counsel, make your appearances, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. Attorney Sean Louise on behalf of Stanley Canosa.
Good morning, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Stephen Tsushima on behalf of the state.
All right, a couple of housekeeping matters, gentlemen. So we are live streaming, and the microphones are very important for purposes of picking up the live stream. So please speak loudly and clearly and directly into the microphone. That would be helpful to us. Please remain at council table while you are throughout the oral argument, and you may argue from there. Please stand when you make your arguments, okay? All right, Mr. Louise, I understand you're reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. I want to thank the court first for allowing oral argument in what I believe is a very important case of first impression in this jurisdiction. And we have to go all the way back to 1873 to look at a case from the United States Supreme Court called Ex parte Lange, in which the United States Supreme Court looked into this issue. If a sentence is served, what happens if the state or the city that's prosecuting an action attempts to resentence the defendant both pre-fulfillment of an execution in full of that sentence or post-execution of that sentence? And I think that's an important point that was set forth in Ex parte Lange that actually covers both of those points. Both if an attempt to resentence to a harsher sentence is prior to the fulfillment of the execution of the sentence in full or post-execution of the sentence in full. And in the Ex parte Lange case, it gives some very helpful examples about someone being sentenced to 4 months and then serving their 4 months, and in the court trying to bring them back in and change the sentence and add terms to that. And in this case, I think the dates are extremely important and the timing of how this case proceeded. The Supreme Court of Hawaii denied Mr. Canosa's application for a writ of certiorari from the 2018 intermediate court opinion. And that was in January of 2019. And then Mr. Canosa's minimum for the underlying sentence, the maximum punishment for the burglary in the first degree and the companion charge, was a maximum of 10 years. And that expired on September 21st, 2019. Now,
if I could interject, where do you point to establish that Mr. Canosa was sentenced to 10 years? And you're talking about count one, by the way, right?
Yes.
So, the judgment, the 2016 judgment, wasn't that an extended 20-year sentence?
It was 10 extended to 20. However, it makes clear that the maximum punishment is 10 subject to extension of 20. So when Mr. Canosa was serving his underlying sentence, when the ICA in 2018 vacated that judgment was vacated. There was no judgment actually holding Mr. Canosa at that point. And the state never brought its action. It could have brought the action. It had January of 2019. It could have initiated remand proceedings in the trial court, and it could have commenced that action and started to attempt to resentence Mr. Pinoza, and it didn't in January 2019, in February 2019, in March, April, May, June, July, August, September 2019, all the way up until the 21st of 2019, they never attempted to resentence Mr. Pinoza. A passage of 12 months had expired at that point, a full 12 months that the state sat on its hands and decided not to resentence Mr. Pinoza, even though the Intermediate Court of Appeals ordered a resentencing proceeding. And Mr. Pinoza, he has no obligation under the rules or the principles of constitutional law to demand that he be sentenced himself. That's the state. The state is the plaintiff in the case. Mr. Pinoza is the defendant. So the state was obligated upon the denial of the writ of certiorari in January of 2019 to go ahead and resentence Mr. Pinoza timely. And the state failed to do so. It waited 12 months and then it didn't even start the proceedings until after that. And June 4th, 2020, those months later, October, November, December, January, February, March, April, May, June, already all those months pass. And finally, Mr. Canosa's sentence. But on the day he was sentenced, he had already fulfilled the maximum underlying punishment of a sentence that was already vacated.
So your argument hinges on a chronology where if the state had moved the lower court to have the resentencing hearing before the 10 years had expired in 2019, that there would be no harm, no foul, that's the key to why Mr. Canosa's resentencing should be vacated a third time by this court.
Yes, Your Honor, because the state was free to resentence him within that proceeding and not prejudice him. And he's been quite prejudiced. If you look at this case, it's amazing the passage of time. We're talking 13 years of legal proceedings have proceeded in this case. I mean, we're talking, this case started in 2009. In 2011, there was a trial, there was a judgment that went up on appeal. It was vacated for improper prosecutorial closing argument, talking about that $75 with the drug transaction. And there was no evidence of whether or not the value of the drugs was $75 or whether there was other property at issue in that dispute over Mr. Canosa and the two complaining witnesses. And that prejudiced him right there. That's the first prejudice. Then he goes up. He felt his counsel was not doing a good job during the second trial. And he asked for new counsel, and there was a mistrial. And I don't think it's fair. I mean, if Mr. Canosa has a right to competent legal counsel and...
Well, that issue is not before us, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So, Mr. Luis, you don't contest, I take it, certainly wasn't in your papers, you don't contest that after the second trial in 2016 that a jury in the sentencing phase found beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Canosa is a persistent offender, that he is a multiple offender, and that extended sentencing is necessary to protect the public. You don't contest that at all, right?
No, Your Honor.
It's just a timing thing with you.
Yes.
Is your argument.
Yes.
And in our second decision on appeal, what I'll call Canosa 2, which vacated just the sentence because of the consecutive sentencing, didn't you already raise the issue about extended sentencing? And didn't this court already affirm the propriety of extended sentencing given the jury's findings after the second trial?
Yes, it did, Your Honor.
So because of your argument then is because the state didn't move fast enough, all of that should be for naught, that basically it's a nullity, all of that. Those determinations would have no effect.
Yes, Your Honor. But I think there is still the possibility of the court raising a plain error, because on the date he was resentenced, technically, the state had to prove not only that he was a that he was a prior or persistent offender. They also had to prove he was a danger to the public. And I mean, after the passage of time, other than the court just looking at the prior jury finding that was already by that time 4 years old, and you know, Mr. Canosa has not committed any crimes while he's been incarcerated. And you know, there is opportunities for prisoners to commit other crimes. We see once in a while a prisoner commits an assault, they commit some kind of crime in prison, whether it's drug possession or something similar, and they're brought into court on charges while they're already serving another sentence.
This argument hasn't been raised in your briefs, correct? These arguments haven't been raised in your briefs. You've not raised these arguments.
It was raised in my opening brief.
Was it raised through the circuit court?
It was not raised to this. Well, was it raised? Don't remember if that particular argument was raised in the circuit court, but I think it's an issue that might be a plain error on appeal, is whether or not the sentence itself, whether or not there was really evidence that's before this court that he really was a danger to the public after the passage of 13 years, after 4 years since his last sentence, and no. So I think I'm just pointing that out because sometimes the court does present itself and raise the plain error itself. And I'm just pointing that out because we are examining the sentence as a whole and then these procedural errors. So looking at that, I believe the court could even raise that plain error and just look, was he really a danger on the date that he's resentenced? And is that really supported by the record as a whole? And does that prejudice him to his substantial detriment? Because, you know, you look at that case from 2004, that famous case named Booker, and the companion one in 2005 that followed from the United States Supreme Court. It says a prior conviction can be used to increase a sentence, but it said if there's facts beyond that, a jury is required. So there was a prior finding in 2016 from that second, that third trial. But when he was sentenced in 2020, June 4th, what real evidence was really presented in the record to support that he was a danger to the public? There is no reference. If you look at all the pages of the transcript that are set forth in the transcript dated June 4th, 2020, that I attached and made part of this record, and also I attached portions of those to my opening brief and reference that in my opening brief, you'll see that there's really no mention or any establishment other than whatever the jury found, but there's no current that finding that's not stale and that's not old and that's not prior. So I think that he's been substantially prejudiced, and you know, it's delayed. You know, the prejudice that he suffers too is it delays his mandatory minimum when he goes for HPA proceedings. It takes that much longer for him to get his mandatory minimum. It takes him that much longer to be able to get all of his programs established. It takes that much longer to be able to get scheduled, be on a waiting list for multiple programs, be able to do those programs. And he is extremely prejudiced now because a new parole board took over. And now, even though he hasn't even been sentenced under a sex offender statute, now they're saying that he's going to have to do sex offender treatment under this new parole board that is now in session, that has just looked at him and just out of the blue pulled him into a hearing and said, oh, you have to do sex offender treatment too, even though you haven't been.
Mr. Luis, I think you are arguing things that are outside of our record.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm just pointing out some ancillary information that I think just important for the court's knowledge. Even if it's not in the record and even if it can't be established, I think just for the sake of knowing what's going on in his case as a whole, just to let the court know that.
Mr. Luis, are you saying then that in a case like this where a case is remanded for resentencing 4 years after the original sentence is vacated, there needs to be a new jury impaneled to determine whether the defendant continues to be a threat to society?
I believe that's a permissible ruling that could be set forth in this case, is that, I mean, 4 years have passed and he's been incarcerated. Other than prior information that is stale at that point, 4 years later, how has the state really proven that he's a danger to the public? And the state cannot rely solely on the prior conviction under Booker and the other cases from the U.S. Supreme Court. They have to prove he's a danger to the public. And there's really nothing in the record in the sentencing transcript when he was resentenced to establish that he was a danger to the public. And the prior conviction in and of itself is insufficient under Booker and the Prodigy from the United States Supreme Court to establish that. And the state didn't take any effort. They conceded the consecutive sentence, but they didn't look to establish or put anything into the record. They didn't call any witnesses. They didn't establish any of the prior facts. They didn't attach transcripts, no new information. There was nothing. It's silent in any establishment that Mr. Knauss is actually a danger to the public.
Thank you.
Mr. Luiz, the one case that you cite for your legal argument in terms of double jeopardy is the Lange case. As you notice, 1800 case. Have you looked at case law that have interpreted Lange and the application of Lange? I mean, it's a very old case, and I think other cases have limited it in terms of its application. Can you point us to any case that actually applies to a circumstance like this? Because in Lange, the problem was that the lower court essentially sentenced the defendant initially to, well, basically sentenced him to sentences that were illegal because it was an either or, and the court, you know, sentenced the defendant to both incarceration and a fine as opposed to either or. So is there any case law since Lange that you can point to that actually has been applied to a situation like this?
When I shepherdized the case, there was about 30 cases flagged, but as I was going through them, I didn't see any case that was particularly on point with this case. And it still looks like, even though there is that distinction, there was an and or in Lange, I think that is still the most similar because there is an and or in this case by the persistent offender statute. It's either 10 years is the maximum punishment or extended to 20. So there is an and or. I think the most important point is to come back to is what did the state do in January of 2019? When the sentence was vacated, it waited 12 months until the passage of time. He passed that 12-month window and fulfilled the maximum underlying punishment for burglary in the first degree. And then that sentence was vacated. So the court vacated the entire judgment. And when the judgment was vacated, the conviction at that point, well, the judgment was vacated, the extended sentence was vacated. So he was just being held on either a prior bail order, or he was being held on a no bail order, but that's the only thing he could possibly be held on because there was no judgment. And as a strategy, I didn't need to bring attention to the case and bring a bail proceeding to ask him to be released. The passage of time, that was going to work in our favor. So it was better for him not to do anything with prior bail orders and remain in custody and let the passage of time come by and let him be able to pursue this argument that he felt they should have resentenced him and they didn't. And there was a judgment vacated.
That was a strategic decision to basically lay low on the defense side.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, in our Canosa 2 opinion, the one that was issued in 2018, I think you said the judgment was vacated. I don't know that that's accurate because I think the convictions were affirmed. The disposition is that the judgment was vacated to the extent it imposes consecutive sentences in violation of HRS 706609. And that was because of the fact that there was consecutive sentencing in that second, after that second jury trial. So that only the sentence was vacated in Canosa 2, isn't that accurate, or How do you argue otherwise?
Yeah, so that sentence has multiple parts to it. And that sentence was vacated. So when his sentence was vacated, the sentence for the conviction was vacated, the extended sentence was vacated technically. And because there's a new judgment. And if you look at the subsequent judgment that comes out from June 4th, 2020, it's not just a partial judgment, it's a full judgment of everything again. So technically, and the court did resentence him on June 4th, 2020 to an extended term. So if the court believed there was an extended term in effect, it would not be logical for the court to resentence him to a extended term, but it resentenced him.
Counsel, sorry. If the sentence on the conviction was vacated, didn't he have to know that he was going to get resentenced? There's no reasonable expectation that he wasn't subject to a brand new sentencing proceeding, right?
Well, he knew that the state was going to resentence him, but he could not anticipate exactly what the state was going to do.
Right.
And I think the most shocking thing is to watch the state sit by for 12 months and not attempt to resentence him. It's their job. And it's no different than a civil case where
but is part of your argument, okay, since the entire sentence is thrown out, the state has to come in and argue its sentence sort of a priori? That's your plain error argument, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So we come to, I feel that in this jurisdiction, the courts have really enforced the defendant's rights to all their constitutional rights. And this is a very good jurisdiction for that. And if you just look at all the decisions we have on the books, it's been very favorable to enforcing the due process rights, the procedural rights, the constitutional rights of defendants. And I'm asking that the court in this case allow Mr. Canosa to be released and sent back to the community because the state failed to resentence him timely and he's been substantially prejudiced as a result. And if the court has no further questions at this time, I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Mr. Tsushima.
And for the record, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Stephen Tsushima, on behalf of the state, good morning, Chief Judge Canosa, and Associate Judge Leonard and Associate Judge Hiroka, good morning to you as well. This was a straightforward resentencing case before the circuit court. I do want to stay consistent with my response in opposition to defendant's motion for retention of oral argument, because I don't believe there's extra articulation or clarification that the state needs to provide. I believe this was a straightforward resentencing. When I did review the submissions that were filed before this court, as well as the sentencing transcript of the resentencing, what I was looking for was a defense referring to authority, whether it be statutory, court rules, case law. And I couldn't find any. He made arguments and he made claims, but he didn't support it with authority. And to his credit, he did refer to this as a case of first impression before this court, which of course jogged me back to law school and my research and writing professor and moot court instructor telling us, don't be too excited to refer to a case as, or argue a case as first impression, because what you're conceding to the appellate court is you have not found any appellate case law to support your position. And that's true in this case as well, because as I reviewed the record, the cases that defendant cited to in his opening brief stood for propositions that supported our position. And that's that the court absolutely had authority to be sentencing defendant to the extended sentences. And that's pursuant to this, you know, general tenets of law that the court only has authority which is given to it statutorily for sentencing.
So, sorry, you can address it when you want, but I would like to hear your response to his plain error argument on whether the state had to prove anew that he, that Mr. Canosa was a danger to the community. And I guess that's tied to his position that the entire sentence was vacated. Right. And I'd like you to address that if you would, please.
Sure. Well, you know, as you're probably well aware, that's new to us because that wasn't raised below. That wasn't raised at sentencing. I don't believe that was even raised in his brief. If it was raised in his brief, it would only be in argument three, which defense counsel raised inappropriately. He didn't even raise it as a point of error. He just argued it. And again, to the extent that he is raising that point, Judge Leonard, again, he cites to no authority again. He, defense on this sentencing are making claims and argument, and it's not supported by anything. It's not even supported by the Constitution. He's referring to double jeopardy case. Again, his the only case that he has, as Chief Judge Ganoza pointed out, the only case that he has supposedly supporting his position actually is an opposite completely to this sentencing procedure. That, as this court is well aware, involved alternate sentencing, a sentencing statute where the court was only authorized to give one or the other. That's not what we have here. And in fact, I did my own research because I wasn't satisfied with what I saw in the opening brief as to authority. So I did my own research. And when I tried to find something that was on point with respect to extended sentencing and when the, whether the court has authority, what the courts, what these courts have said in this jurisdiction, as well as all the jurisdictions across the country and federal case law, is that what the defendant faces as the maximum sentence is the maximum sentence which is authorized by statute. And what those cases will say is it includes enhancements that are authorized by statute.
So are you arguing that the state could wait 19 years or some infinite? I mean, I think part of his beef here is that on remand, you didn't immediately seek resentencing, and he feels that he was prejudiced by that in various ways, that some of which are not in the record, of course, but not based on authority, but there is some appeal to that concept that the state shouldn't just sit around and wait for years before seeking resentencing. How long do you get to wait?
I don't know that there is anything bright line. Of course, you know, as you say, I don't think we can or should wait 19 years, of course, to resentence. But to answer that situation, if defendant could show prejudice by it, I think we'd be in trouble. Just like in this case, if he were able to show prejudice of us waiting, I think he said 12 months. I'm not sure on the record on that. But if he could show prejudice, then yeah, I think we would be in trouble for waiting that long. In fact, it's kind of ironic that he points that out, because the only reason he has an argument today about his ordinary terms, in his words, expiring, is because of that 12-month period. By his own admission, if it had done, as Chief Judge Canosa pointed out, let's say immediately when it was remanded back, then his argument wouldn't even be valid today, because his whole argument rests on the fact that he's saying, and I don't know the exact date, but on a certain date that 10 years had lapsed. So actually the only prejudice he would be able to argue is when we waited during that time, what prejudice did he suffer?
Mr. Tsushima, it's a year and a half, though. It is a year and a half. So the Supreme Court denied writ of cert on January 18, 2019, beginning of 2019. The hearing for the resentencing wasn't until June of 2020. Okay. That's quite a long time. And I think it's in your folks' briefing where you folks basically say there's really nothing in the record to explain that delay. So, you know, I think it is an understandable concern for a defendant sitting incarcerated. You know, the courts have done what they've done on the, this was our second, appellate decision, and it's now been put back into the trial court. So it's an understandable concern. Don't you agree that a defendant wait that long for resentencing?
I do agree. And the reason I had a question as to what the record was I did have a feeling that it was an odd number. You mentioned it's a year and a half. I did feel it was an odd number of months, not 12 months exactly. But I of course don't know what happened in this case too. And I do agree that's a concern. What this court should be concerned with is, as Judge Leonard had pointed out, like what's the prejudice though is the thing. We should try to bring it forth sooner. And I think that is a problem. I don't know what his remedy would be in this case though, because would he be facing something differently had we brought it sooner? I would submit not. If we had brought it immediately, if somehow the system had allowed for us to remand it within days and he was sentenced, I would submit he would have been sentenced just the same. Exactly.
So do you have authority supporting what seems to be the position that you don't have to prove at the new sentencing hearing independently that he's still a danger to the community? You can rely on.
I don't have authority for that either. I wasn't ready to bring up authority because this hadn't been previously raised, except that I'm unaware of any situation where the prior finding by the jury was attacked for that reason, by age alone, that upon resentencing, I'm not aware of a case where an extended was brought back and then that, by reason of age alone, the jury's finding for extended sentences is vacated. I'll just say that. I'm not aware of a case, but, I would have liked to have the opportunity.
So your argument is, because it's a jury, just to be clear, I'm not arguing with you, but your argument is, sorry, my glasses are going crazy, that because it's a jury's finding that has not been set aside, that's essentially law of the case, and we don't need a new finding. Is that okay? Thank you.
Mr. Tsushima, the case that the defense does raise, of course, is the Lang case. And, I guess I'd like just your, argument with regards to that Lang case. You folks didn't even address it in the answering brief, so.
Sure. Yeah, I did. I did notice that, too. I don't want to try to guess into the head of the appellate deputy who did the briefing.
Yeah, so I'm asking for you.
But, I have my input on it. As he pointed out, it's a 150-year-old case. And as you pointed out, there's about 1,281 cases that cited to it. And, I was not able to go through all of them, but I went through at least 100 of the first cases. And as you pointed out, most of them limited the finding. I found none that applied to extended sentencing and said that this is like here in an extended sentencing. Most of them cited it for the general proposition of when double jeopardy applies to a defendant because he is suffering two punishments. And that's where it's not triggered in this case because the Code of Criminal Procedure authorized the trial court to sentence defendant as it did. So when I was reading Ex parte Lang, I was looking at head note 5, and that's what particularly explained what the holding in that case was. And it says, when a court has imposed fine and imprisonment where the statute only conferred power to punish by fine or imprisonment, and the fine has been paid, it cannot, even during the same term, modify the judgment by imposing imprisonment instead of the former sentence. So that involved alternative punishments, fine or imprisonment. And that's not what we're looking at here. We're looking at an extended sentencing authorized by 706-61 and 706-62. Although defense counsel tries to describe it as it really isn't. It's just extending what the sentence maximum would otherwise be, but it's based off a finding that's already made by the jury. And then the sentencing judge, does as it did in this case. It then verifies whether it would be appropriate. And that's what the sentencing judge did. It looked at the record, it looked at his extensive prior criminal history, and said, that is the basis. So I'm finding, based off the jury's finding, as well as his criminal history, that the extended sentence are necessary and appropriate in this case. And if this court is interested, what that extensive criminal history involved, and it is part of the record, it was filed in our extended sentencing. That's five felonies, eight misdemeanors, two petty misdemeanors, and those felonies included two sexual assaults in the first degree.
You know, Mr. Luis argues essentially, right, that the ordinary sentence was imposed and then it was extended. I mean, I don't know that you can read that from the judgment, but how would you interpret the language in the judgment? Does the language in the judgment matter?
No, and that's not the way it's read. The way it's read is the court is either going to apply that extended if it finds it appropriate or not. And when it does, that's the sentence that's given. The way defense counsel is trying to characterize and understand, it's the only way his argument stands, is he's trying to say it's one and or the other, and then you attach the two. No, that's not what it is. It's you're looking at the sentence, and it's either limited to this or you're going to be extending it, and it's greater. The maximum is greater. And that's the problem. When he was resentenced, he was not facing a maximum of 10 years. He was facing 20. And so this expiring thing that he's talking about, where it's flawed his argument, is that the maximum sentence that he was facing was not the 10 years, it was 20. So even on his own argument, we would still have 20 years in which to have sentenced, which the court would have had authority sentenced defendant. If it had been beyond 20, then I would agree with his argument.
At any time prior to, well, this is the third appeal, and in the second resentencing, was at that point the underlying 5-year on count 3 would have been expired under the defense's theory. Do you know from the record whether this argument about an expiring ordinary term has been raised anywhere before in the record prior to?
I do not believe so. Not from my review of the record. I'm not sure if this court will find it in any of the submissions. I don't remember seeing that. The first time I remember that I recall seeing it is in the briefing on the third argument. I believe so.
The resentencing in 2020.
Right.
Okay.
And I really don't have anything further unless this court has any further questions. So thank you.
I guess I had one more question. Mr. Luis said, and I'll go back and check, but he said that in ex parte laying, there was an example given where if a defendant was sentenced to 4 months, served 4 months, and then the court called him back in, that would be prohibited. Is that your recollection or understanding of a proposition in that case?
That is not my understanding of the proposition of... Okay. Ex parte Lang, and again, Head Note 5, I believe, covers exactly what the Supreme Court was saying in that case. And I believe it is limited to that.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I do have a question, Mr. Tsushima. Going back to this plain error issue, and I realize that you feel you've been sandbagged, but I just want to get your thoughts on this. If the jury's findings upon which the extended sentence was based are never vacated. After the resentencing, wouldn't it be something for the parole board to consider whether the defendant continues to pose a danger to the community, as opposed to having to swear another jury and have them find an issue that was never vacated in the first place?
I think what they would do and should do would be to look at what that jury had before it presented to it as evidence that we presented why defendant was a danger to the public. My understanding is in these cases, it's a pretty basic, plain presentation. Particularly when it pertains to persistent offender, we're simply showing the prior felonies that he was convicted for, showing proof of when he was convicted of it. And in my understanding, without having the transcript, because it wasn't made part of the record, without having the ability to have read that transcript, what I'm sure it will show is the same. It'll be the five felonies that I referred to. And that's going to be the basis upon which the jury would have made its finding. To that extent, I don't see why a second trial or hearing to the jury on the extended would be necessary, because it's merely a proof of those prior felonies. So defense's argument would merely be why those five prior felonies are not relevant now, 4 years later.
Well, couldn't he also be arguing he's rehabilitated, he's a different person? I mean, couldn't there be other, he's had treatment, I don't know if he made any of those arguments, but is it really 13 years out limited to the issue of what the jury found in the first instance? Is that your argument?
Yeah, I just don't know that it, to me, would be relevant in the grand scheme of things, in the grand scheme of what was presented to the jury as to what made him a danger to the public. And again, I would have liked an opportunity to have researched it to see if another court had already gone over this and whether time alone is a factor to then find the prior finding to be not something that the court could rely upon.
Based on public policy considerations, who would you say is more competent to determine whether a defendant continues to pose a risk to the community? A circuit court judge or the paroling authority?
I don't think I'm a good person to make a determination on that. I would hope the paroling authority is in a good position to make that, because
that's what it does, isn't it?
Right, because it can take into consideration the type of new arguments that may arise in the time pending. So, since that's what they already do, I would hope they could take that into consideration in making their determinations.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you. And if that's all, I just want to thank the court for its time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Luis?
Yes, Your Honor. So I'd like to take Your Honor's question first, and I might be a little out of order. I just want to try to address everything that the state raised. So the question posed was, whose job is it really to decide if Mr. Canosa is a danger to the public? In the first instance, it is actually the circuit court's job to do that, not the parole board. And the parole board only works with what it's given by the circuit court.
Isn't the circuit court bound by the jury's determination on that issue for extended sentencing purposes?
Once the judgment was vacated, it wasn't bound in the state, because under that Booker case, the state must still prove that he's a danger to the public beyond his prior sentence. And there was a passage of time of 4 years. So the state can't really say that he's a danger at that point when it's 4 years later. There's no record of him committing any more crimes in the facility. There's no attempted escapes. There's nothing to support that he would actually be a danger to the public.
Was the jury finding upon which the extended sentence based ever vacated?
No, it's not, Your Honor. But by the passage of time, the question is whether it's stale or it should still operate.
Do you have a case that says that there's a statute of limitations on the law of the case?
Well, I think that goes back to the case of Wong versus City and County of Honolulu.
The traffic light case.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. Thank you. So that's a very important case to point out, because the case does point out that if there's cogent reasons to distinguish and change a judgment that was already in effect, that the rules of comity don't apply at that point, because there might be new facts that have come in. And I mean, that was the thing with the Wong v. City and County of Honolulu, is it was very important to point out for the court in the opinion that There can be changed circumstances. And in this case, there are changed circumstances.
And counsel, who has the legislature determined is in the best position to make a decision whether the circumstances have changed after a defendant has been sentenced?
After it's been sentenced, it's only the parole job's duty to decide. I mean, eventually the person's going to be let out because they're going to fulfill their sentence. So it can't be whether or not they're going to be a perceived danger or whether they could be a danger in the future, because they're going to fulfill their sentence and they're going to be released and they're going to be on the streets again.
Well, doesn't the parole board decide if they can get released early?
It only decides if their behavior is good and if they've completed programs that would prevent them from being a recidivist. If they're fit to be released early for good behavior or completing programs. And
right, that's what the parole board decides, right?
Yes, but in the first instance, the statutes direct the circuit court to do the sentencing. And it's the circuit court's obligation to sentence and find whether or not Mr. Canosa was a danger to the public. So the parole board doesn't decide whether or not Mr. Canosa is a danger to the public, where he would get an extended sentence of 10 to 20. That's not the parole board's role.
I'm sorry. That's not what I meant to imply, Mr. Lewis. I apologize if I misled you. The circuit court imposes an extended sentence if the jury finds facts that warrant.
That's correct.
Once that sentence is imposed, if Mr. Canosa gets 20 years for Burley 1, isn't it the parole authority's statutory function to determine whether he still poses a danger to the public so that it could consider releasing him early on parole?
No, their job is to make sure that he fulfills his reprogramming in his programs to make sure that he's not likely to be a recidivist, or he will comply with the terms and conditions if the parole board releases him. But he
isn't that another way of saying he's no longer a danger to the public?
No, because everyone would present some form of danger to the public. It's only whether or not this is, because parole is supposed to benefit the defendant. It might ancillarily benefit the public, but first it benefits the defendant. The defendant is given an incentive to do these programs and comply to be able to get released in the program. I mean, and it's not an easy program. First, they have to get on waiting list and they have to do all these programs. And it takes a long time for them to get off the waiting list and get into the programs. And then sometimes the classes get canceled and they don't have instructors to teach. And then they have to do that. And then in addition, a lot of times they make them do work furlough, and then they have to go in and out of the facility with OCCC. They have to do their day job. They go out, they get a job, and then they come back, they stay overnight in OCCC, and then they go back out, they do their job, and they do that their 5 days a week to make income so they can pocket money and put in an account so they can be released, get an apartment.
If they're able to do all of that, overcome all of those adversities, isn't that a pretty good indication that the defendant no longer poses a threat to society?
No, because we're not just talking about that. We're talking about does the parole board even have the authority to consider the first 10 or the second 10, 20 total or 10?
So, no, I'm not. I'm sorry again. I am not distinguishing between the 10 and the extended 20. I'm just saying whatever a defendant's sentence is, it could be life with possibility of parole. Doesn't the parole board take into account whether the defendant is going to be a threat to society if released early?
Well, I can tell you that I don't see that in the orders from the parole board. It usually says the board is not convinced that you have fulfilled your program, and the board is not convinced you have done this. The board is not convinced. But I mean, of course, even public safety would not let someone out if they were a danger to the public, and they would oppose it. And the prosecutors, but see, the prosecutors get to come in and argue against someone's release on supervision. And they get to, that's their job, is to argue. It's actually the state's job. The state, as the plaintiff, argues whether or not a defendant is a danger to the public. And they come in quite frequently in the parole proceedings, and they argue that the person is a danger to the public.
So that is an issue that comes up then, isn't it?
It does come up, but the question is what was given to the parole board to work with? That is, to me, the more important issue. Was the parole board given a 10-year term to look at and decide when the person completes all their programs and whether they will be released in the community, they're not likely to be a recidivist, or is it a 20-year? Because if you even look, I mean, if it's a consecutive, normally, you know, someone gets a mandatory minimum with a consecutive, they got to serve that first mandatory minimum. If they get a second one, it's consecutive, they got to. And I think Judge Leonard's question to the state was very good about the 19 years. What if the state waited 19 years and 11 months and then decided it wanted to resentence Mr. Canosa? And that was one of my examples last night I was thinking about. What if it said, well, you know, originally he was actually sentenced to a 10-year extended to life with parole. And what if they waited till 19 years and 11 months and said, well, we just like to resentence you, and we don't think that because you already have been originally sentenced to a harsher sentence, you should have to do another sentence and a longer one. And what if they came back and wanted, what if they waited and never sentenced Mr. Canosa to that 20? And what if they waited 19-1 and just asked for resentence again for consecutive? And then he'd actually have to appeal. He'd already be past that 20 years. And how many years, one, two, it would go before he could even challenge that finding. So that is really what is so important in this case and that distinguishment. And then I think,
Luis, I do want to note your time. Your 10 minutes rebuttal is up. We'll allow you to summarize your argument, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could just cover maybe some.
You know, if you don't mind, Judge Canosa, I have one more question. Before Judge Hiroka started asking about the parole board, you said that there were changed circumstances in this case. What changed circumstances in the record are you talking about after the initial findings?
There's no record. There's nothing in the record to support that Mr. Canosa is a danger to the public at this
point. But is there something in the record just to support that he's not?
Yes, that there's no other crimes committed during that period.
Okay, so, all right, thanks. Appreciate the answer.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. And then, you know, the state did not address that 4 months, but it talks about right on page 15 of my brief, it talks about that 4 months as an example. So that is there, and I think that is on point. And then, you know, this is not really, the state argues this is a straightforward case, but a case of first impression cannot be a straightforward case. And that's the reason why it's a case of first impression. And then if you go back, I mean, just because the ex parte Lange is from 1873 does not mean it's still in effect in good law, because it has not been overruled. And I didn't see those number of cases when I did my search on Westlaw. I seen 30 come up that just mentioned it. But when I started going through them, I didn't see anything that actually addressed that same argument that was set forth in Ex parte Young. And our Constitution is what, ratified in 1789, the First Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the 14th Amendment later. It's like all these constitutional laws, they're hundreds of years old, but they're still in effect.
Mr. Luis, please sum up.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. And then also, I would like to say my client doesn't have really an obligation to help point out to the state and help them prove that he's a danger to the public. That's their job under this persistent offender. They have to show Mr. Canosa is a danger to the public. My client is not obligated to prove he's a danger to the public. That's their job. And they fail to do so, other than in the record alone, under the Booker and the progeny, is not enough. And he is prejudiced, because he would have Within 2-3 months, the court resets. If you're resentenced, the parole board resets that mandatory minimum. And all that time has gone by before he even got sentenced to his mandatory minimum. So he is prejudiced. But in summation, I just want to go back to my opening comment that, in light of what the state said, you know, sometimes when you're doing an appeal, the appellate counsel, when you're there in the courtroom, it might not be that obvious of what's going on, but when you're the appellate counsel and you review the record as a whole, and you're looking at that, you're like, wow, on the appeal, did the state even submit anything other than a prior conviction that he's a danger to the public? And the state did not. And that's not really going to be apparent until the appellate counsel reviews the record in the court as well. And that's why the court has this plain error rule that applies. And a lot of times I just point out the plain error that I see, and I'm sure the court is going to see it as well at some point. Sometimes they agree with me and sometimes they don't. There's been multiple cases where the courts agreed with something being a plain error, even though it wasn't raised. And me, my job is to zealously represent all my clients, rich, poor, tall, small. I just have to represent them all. I'm court appointed in this case. I take my job with the same ethics, whether they pay me or whether I'm appointed, and I advocate for them. And
I think you've done a really good job.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. And I just feel, Mr. Canosa, I feel this is wrong. And that's why, you know, if you look, I've been the longest counsel, really. I mean, 5 years, I was appointed in 2016, and I stay his counsel. We have ups and downs. We get into arguments. He wants me to do things. You see the record, the transcript, where the judge is letting him sometimes argue instead of me. And we don't always agree, but he's with me. He works with me because he wants my help. I help him. And I just think, as you look at this record, this is really prejudicial to him, and he's been really prejudiced, and this is unfair. The state should have, in 2019, January, they should have brought him into court and asked for him to be resentenced. They could have called me, they could have emailed me, they could have emailed the court, they could have asked.
Counsel, you are regurgitating the arguments that you've made. I've asked you to sum up twice now, so yeah. We've given you quite a bit of extra time.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. I really
thank you. Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement. Thank you both.